so. There was a subtle change in his voice. Backed by the Privy Secretary, eh? Good money.
To get back to the subject, urged Barr.
No, but wait, interrupted the Commissioner. Let us go back by easy stages. I really do wish to know what your business can be. This money, it is fresh and new, and you must have a good deal, for it strikes me that you have seen other officials before me.
Come now.
What about it? Barr said, I don't see what you are driving at. Why, see here, it might be proven that you are upon the planet illegally, since the identification and entry cards of your silent friend are certainly inadequate. He is not a subject of the Emperor.
I deny that.
It doesn't matter that you do, said the Commissioner with sudden bluntness. The official who signed his cards for the sum of 100 credits has confessed, under pressure, and we know more of you than you think. If you were hinting, sir, that the sum we have asked you to accept is inadequate in view of the risks, the Commissioner smiled. On the contrary, it is more than adequate. He tossed the bills aside. To return to what I was saying, it is the Emperor himself who has become interested in your case. Is it not true, sirs, that you have recently been guests of General Rio's? Is it not true that you have escaped from the midst of his army with, to put it mildly, astonishing ease? Is it not true that you possess a small fortune in bills backed by Lord Broderick's estates? In short, is it not true that you are a pair of spies and assassins sent here to— Well, you shall tell us yourself who paid you and for what.
Do you know, said Barr with silky anger, I deny the right of a petty commissioner to accuse us of crimes. We will leave.
You will not leave. The Commissioner arose, and his eyes no longer seemed nearsighted. You need answer no question now. That will be reserved for a later and more forceful time. Nor am I a commissioner. I am a lieutenant of the Imperial Police. You are under arrest. There was a glitteringly efficient blast gun in his fist as he smiled. There are greater men than you under arrest this day. It is a hornet's nest we are cleaning up. Devers snarled and reached slowly for his own gun. The lieutenant of police smiled more broadly and squeezed the contacts. The blasting line of force struck Devers' chest in an accurate blaze of destruction that bounced harmlessly off his personal shield in sparkling spicules of light. Devers shot in turn, and the lieutenant's head fell from off an upper torso that had disappeared. It was still smiling as it lay in the jag of sunshine which entered through the new-made hole in the wall. It was through the back entrance that they left. Devers said huskily, quickly to the ship, "They'll have the alarm out in no time." He cursed in a ferocious whisper. "It's another plan that's backfired. I could swear the space fiend himself was against me." It was in the open that they became aware of the jabbering crowds that surrounded the huge televisors. They had no time to wait. The disconnected, roaring words that reached them, they disregarded. But Barr snatched a copy of the Imperial News before diving into the huge barn of the hangar, where the ship lifted hastily through a giant cavity burnt fiercely into the roof.
"Can you get away from them?" asked Barr.
10 ships of the traffic police wildly followed the runaway craft that had burst out of the lawful, radio-beamed path of leaving, and then broken every speed law in creation. Further behind still, sleek vessels of the Secret Service were lifting in pursuit of a carefully described ship manned by 2 thoroughly identified murderers. "Watch me," said Devers, and savagely shifted into hyperspace, 2,000 miles above the surface of Trantor. The shift, so near a planetary mass, meant unconsciousness for Barr and a fearful haze of pain for Devers. But light years further,
Space above them was clear. Devers' somber pride in his ship burst to the surface. He said, "There's not an Imperial ship that could follow me anywhere." And then, bitterly, "But there is nowhere left to run to for us, and we can't fight their weight." "What's there to do? What can anyone do?" Barr moved feebly on his cot. The effect of the hypershift had not yet worn off, and each of his muscles ached. He said, "No one has to do anything. It's all over. Here." He passed the copy of the Imperial News that he still clutched, and the headlines were enough for the traitor. "Recalled and arrested. Rios and Broderick," Devers muttered. He stared blankly at Barr. "Why?" "The story doesn't say, but what does it matter? The war with the Foundation is over, and at this moment Suenna is revolting. Read the story and see." His voice was drifting off. "We'll stop in some of the provinces and find out the later details. If you don't mind, I'll go to sleep now." And he did. In grasshopper jumps of increasing magnitude, the trade ship was spanning the galaxy in its return to the Foundation. Chapter 10. The War Ends. Lathan Devers felt definitely uncomfortable and vaguely resentful. He had received his own decoration and withstood with mute stoicism the turgid oratory of the mayor which accompanied the slip of crimson ribbon. That had ended his share of the ceremonies, but naturally, formality forced him to remain. And it was formality, chiefly, the type that couldn't allow him to yawn noisily or to swing a foot comfortably onto a chair seat, that made him long to be in space, where he belonged. The Suenese delegation, with Duke Umbar, a lionized member, signed the convention, and Suenna became the first province to pass directly from the Empire's political rule to the Foundation's economic one. 5 Imperial ships of the line, captured when Suenna rebelled behind the lines of the Empire's border fleet, flashed overhead, huge and massive, detonating a roaring salute as they passed over the city. Nothing but drinking, etiquette, and small talk now. A voice called him. It was Pharrell, the man who, Devers realized coldly, could buy 20 of him with a morning's profits, but a Pharrell who now crooked a finger at him with genial condescension. He stepped out upon the balcony into the cool night wind and bowed properly while scowling into his bristling beard. Barr was there too, smiling. He said, "Devers, you'll have to come to my rescue. I'm being accused of modesty, a horrible and thoroughly unnatural crime." "Devers," Pharrell removed the fat cigar from the side of his mouth when he spoke, "Lord Barr claims that your trip to Cleon's capital had nothing to do with the recall of Rios."
"Nothing at all, sir." Devers was curt. "We never saw the Emperor. The reports we picked up on our way back concerning the trial showed it up to be the purest frame-up. There was a mess of rigmarole about the general being tied up with subversive interests at the court."
"And he was innocent."
"Rios?" interposed Barr.
"Yes. By the galaxy, yes. Broderick was a traitor on general principles, but was never guilty of the specific accusations brought against him. It was a judicial farce, but a necessary one, a predictable one, an inevitable one."
"By psychohistorical necessity, I presume." Pharrell rolled the phrase sonorously with the humorous ease of long familiarity.
"Exactly." Barr grew serious.
"It never penetrated earlier, but once it was over and I could, well, look at the answers in the back of the book, the problem became simple.
We can see now that the social background of the Empire makes wars of conquest impossible for it. Under weak emperors, it is torn apart by generals competing for a worthless and surely death-bringing throne. Under strong emperors, the Empire is frozen into a paralytic rigor in which disintegration apparently ceases for the moment, but only at the sacrifice of all possible growth. Pharrell growled bluntly through strong puffs. You're not clear, Lord Barr.
Barr smiled slowly.
I suppose so. It's the difficulty of not being trained in psychohistory. Words are a pretty fuzzy substitute for mathematical equations. But let's see now.
Barr considered while Pharrell relaxed, back to railing, and Devers looked into the velvet sky and thought wonderingly of Trantor.
Then Barr said, You see, sir, you and Devers, and everyone, no doubt, had the idea that beating the Empire meant first prying apart the Emperor and his general. You and Devers and everyone else were right. Right all the time, as far as the principle of internal disunion was concerned. You were wrong, however, in thinking that this internal split was something to be brought about by individual acts, by inspirations of the moment. You tried bribery and lies. You appealed to ambition and to fear, but you got nothing for all your pains. In fact, appearances were worse after each attempt. And through all this wild threshing up of tiny ripples, the Selden tidal wave continued onward, quietly, but quite irresistibly.
Duke-en-Barre turned away and looked over the railing at the lights of a rejoicing city. He said, There was a dead hand pushing all of us. The mighty general and the great emperor, my world and your world. The dead hand of Harry Selden. He knew that a man like Rio's would have to fail, since it was his success that brought failure, and the greater the success, the surer the failure.
Pharrell said dryly, I can't say you're getting clearer.
A moment, continued Barr earnestly. Look at the situation. A weak general could never have endangered us, obviously. A strong general during the time of a weak emperor would never have endangered us either, for he would have turned his arms towards a much more fruitful target. Events have shown that 3/4 of the emperors of the last 2 centuries were rebel generals and rebel viceroys before they were emperors. So it is only the combination of strong emperor and strong general that can harm the foundation. For a strong emperor cannot be dethroned easily, and a strong general is forced to turn outwards past the frontiers. But what keeps the emperor strong? What kept Cleon strong? It's obvious. He is strong because he permits no strong subjects. A courtier who becomes too rich, or a general who becomes too popular, is dangerous. All the recent history of the Empire proves that to any emperor intelligent enough to be strong. Rio's won victories, so the emperor grew suspicious. All the atmosphere of the times forced him to be suspicious. Did Rio's refuse a bribe? Very suspicious. Ulterior motives. Did his most trusted courtier suddenly favor Rio's? Very suspicious. Ulterior motives. It wasn't the individual acts that were suspicious. Anything else would have done. Which is why our individual plots were unnecessary and rather futile. It was the success of Rio's that was suspicious. So he was recalled and accused, condemned, murdered. The Foundation wins again. Look, there is not a conceivable combination of events that does not result in the Foundation winning. It was inevitable. Whatever Rios did, whatever we did.
The Foundation magnate nodded ponderously.
So, but what if the Emperor and the General had been the same person? Eh? What then? That's a case you didn't cover, so you haven't proved your point yet.
Barr shrugged.
I can't prove anything. I haven't the mathematics. But I appeal to your reason. With an empire in which every aristocrat, every strong man, every pirate can aspire to the throne, and, as history shows, often successfully, what would happen to even a strong emperor who preoccupied himself with foreign wars at the extreme end of the galaxy? How long would he have to remain away from the capital before somebody raised the standards of civil war and forced him home? The social environment of the empire would make that time short. I once told Rios that not all the Empire's strength could swerve the dead hand of Harry Seldon.
Good.
Good! Pharrell was expansively pleased. Then you imply the Empire can never threaten us again.
It seems to me so, agreed Barr.
Frankly, Cleon may not live out the year. And there's going to be a disputed succession almost as a matter of course, which might mean the last civil war for the Empire.
Then, said Pharrell, there are no more enemies.
Barr was thoughtful.
There's a second Foundation.
At the other end of the galaxy? Not for centuries.
Devers turned suddenly at this, and his face was dark as he faced Pharrell.
There are internal enemies, perhaps.
Are there? Asked Pharrell, coolly.
Who, for instance?
People, for instance, who might like to spread the wealth a bit and keep it from concentrating too much out of the hands that work for it.
See what I mean?
Slowly, Pharrell's gaze lost its contempt and grew one with the anger of Devers' own.
Part 2. The Mule. The Mule. Less is known of the Mule than of any character of comparable significance to galactic history. Even the period of his greatest renown is known to us chiefly through the eyes of his antagonists, and principally through those of a young bride. Encyclopedia Galactica. Chapter 11. Bride and Groom. Beta's first sight of Haven was entirely the contrary of spectacular. Her husband pointed it out, a dull star lost in the emptiness of the galaxy's edge. It was past the last sparse clusters to where straggling points of light gleamed lonely. And even among these, it was poor and inconspicuous. Torren was quite aware that as the earliest prelude to married life, the red dwarf lacked impressiveness and his lips curled self-consciously.
I know, Bay. It isn't exactly a proper change, is it? I mean, from the Foundation to this.
A horrible change, Torren. I should never have married you. And when his face looked momentarily hurt before he caught himself, she said with her special cozy tone,
All right, silly, now let your lower lip droop and give me that special dying duck look, the one just before you're supposed to bury your head on my shoulder while I stroke your hair full of static electricity.
You were fishing for some drivel, weren't you?
You were expecting me to say I'd be happy anywhere with you, Torren, or the interstellar depths themselves would be home, my sweet, were you but with me.
Now you admit it.
She pointed a finger at him and snatched it away an instant before his teeth closed upon it. He said, If I surrender and admit you're right, will you prepare dinner?
She nodded contentedly. He smiled and just looked at her. She wasn't beautiful on the grand scale to others, he admitted that, even if everybody did look twice. Her hair was dark and glossy, though straight, her mouth a bit wide, but her meticulous, close-textured eyebrows separated a white, unlined forehead from the warmest mahogany eyes ever filled with smiles. And behind a very sturdily built and staunchly defended facade of practical, unromantic, hard-headedness towards life, there was just that little pool of softness that would never show if you poked for it, but could be reached if you knew just how, and never let on that you were looking for it. Torin adjusted the controls unnecessarily and decided to relax. He was one interstellar jump and then several millimicroparsecs on the straight before manipulation by hand was necessary. He leaned over backwards to look into the storeroom where Beta was juggling appropriate containers. There was quite a bit of smugness about his attitude towards Beta. The satisfied awe that marks the triumph of someone who has been hovering at the edge of an inferiority complex for 3 years. After all, he was a provincial. And not merely a provincial, but the son of a renegade trader. And she was of the Foundation itself. And not merely that, but she could trace her ancestry back to Mallow. And with all that, a tiny quiver underneath. To take her back to Haven, with its rock world and cave cities, was bad enough. To have her face the traditional hostility of trader for Foundation, nomad for city dweller, was worse. Still, after supper, the last jump. Haven was an angry crimson blaze, and the second planet was a ruddy patch of light with atmosphere blurred rim and a half-sphere of darkness. Beta leaned over the large view table with its spidering of crisscross lines that centered Haven 2 neatly. She said gravely, "I wish I had met your father first. If he takes a dislike to me..." "Then," said Torin matter-of-factly, "you would be the first pretty girl to inspire that in him. Before he lost his arm and stopped roving around the galaxy, he... Well, if you ask him about it, he'll talk to you about it till your ears wear down to a nubbin. After a while, I got to thinking that he was embroidering, because he never told the same story twice the same way." Haven 2 was rushing up at them now. The landlocked sea wheeled ponderously below them, slate gray in the lowering dimness and lost to sight here and there among the wispy clouds. Mountains jutted raggedly along the coast. The sea became wrinkled with nearness, and as it veered off past the horizon just at the end, there was one vanishing glimpse of shore-hugging ice fields. Torin grunted under the fierce deceleration, "Is your suit locked?" Beta's plump face was round and ruddy in the encasing sponge foam of the internally heated, skin-clinging costume. The ship lowered crunchingly on the open field just short of the lifting of the plateau. They climbed out awkwardly into the solid darkness of the outer galactic night, and Beta gasped as the sudden cold bit and the thin wind swirled emptily. Torin seized her elbow and nudged her into an awkward run over the smooth, packed ground towards the sparking of artificial light in the distance. The advancing guards met them halfway, and after a whispered exchange of words, they were taken onward. The wind and the cold disappeared when the gate of rock opened and then closed behind them. The warm interior, white with wall light, was filled with an incongruous humming bustle. Men looked up from their desks, and Torin produced documents. They were waved onward after a short glance, and Torin whispered to his wife, "Dad must have fixed up the preliminaries. The usual lapse here is about 5 hours." They burst into the open, and Beta said suddenly, "Oh, my." The cave city was in daylight. The white daylight of a young sun. Not that there was a sun, of course. What should have been the sky was lost in the unfocused glow of an overall brilliance, and the warm air was properly thick and fragrant with greenery.
Beta said, "Why, Torin, it's beautiful."
Torin grinned with anxious delight. "Well now, Bay, it isn't like anything on the Foundation, of course, but it's the biggest city on Haven 2. 20,000 people, you know, and you'll get to like it. No amusement palaces, I'm afraid, but no secret police either."
"Oh, Tori, it's just like a toy city. It's all white and pink, and so clean."
"Well," Torin looked at the city with her. The houses were two stories high for the most part, and of the smooth, vein rock indigenous to the region. The spires of the Foundation were missing, and the colossal community houses of the old kingdoms, but the smallness was there, and the individuality, a relic of personal initiative in a galaxy of mass life. He snapped to sudden attention.
"Bay, there's Dad. Right there.
Where I'm pointing, silly. Don't you see him?" She did. It was just the impression of a large man waving frantically, fingers spread wide as though groping wildly in air. The deep thunder of a drawn-out shout reached them. Beta trailed her husband, rushing downwards over the close-cropped lawn. She caught sight of a smaller man, white-haired, almost lost to view behind the robust one arm, who still waved and still shouted. Torin cried over his shoulder, "It's my father's half-brother, the one who's been to the Foundation, you know." They met in the grass, laughing and incoherent, and Torin's father let out a final whoop for sheer joy. He hitched at his short jacket and adjusted the metal-chased belt that was his one concession to luxury. His eyes shifted from one of the youngsters to the other, and then he said, a little out of breath, "You picked a rotten day to return home, boy."
"What? Oh, it is Selden's birthday, isn't it?"
"It is. I had to rent a car to make the trip here, and Dragoon Randu to drive it. Not a public vehicle to be had at gun's point." His eyes were on Beta now and didn't leave. He spoke to her more softly. "I have the crystal of you right here. And it's good, but I can see the fellow who took it was an amateur." He had the small cube of transparency out of his jacket pocket, and in the light, the laughing little face within sprang to vivid colored life as a miniature Beta.
"That one," said Beta.
"Now I wonder why Torin should send that caricature.
I'm surprised you let me come near you, sir."
"Are you now? Call me Fran. I'll have none of this fancy mess. For that, I think you can take my arm and we'll go on to the car. Till now, I never did think my boy knew what he was ever up to. I think I'll change that opinion. I think I'll have to change that opinion." Torin said to his half-uncle softly, "How is the old man these days? Does he still hound the women?" Randu puckered up all over his face when he smiled. "When he can, Torin, when he can. There are times when he remembers that his next birthday will be his 60th, and that disheartens him. But he shouts it down, this evil thought, and then he is himself. He is a traitor of the ancient type. But you, Torin, where did you find such a pretty wife?" The young man chuckled and linked arms. "Do you want a 3 years history at a gasp, uncle?" It was in the small living room of the home that Beta struggled out of her traveling cloak and hood and shook her hair loose. She sat down, crossing her knees, and returned the appreciative stare of this large, ruddy man. She said, "I know what you're trying to estimate, and I'll help you. Age, 24, height, 5'4", weight, 110, educational specialty, history." She noticed that he always crooked his stand so as to hide the missing arm. But now Fran leaned close and said, "Since you mention it, weight, 120. He laughed loudly at her flush. Then he said to the company in general, "You can always tell a woman's weight by her upper arm. With due experience, of course." Do you want a drink, Bay?
Among other things, she said, and they left together while Torin busied himself at the bookshelves to check for new editions.
Fran returned alone and said, she'll be down later.
He lowered himself heavily into the large corner chair and placed his stiff-jointed left leg on the stool before it. The laughter had left his red face, and Torin turned to face him.
Fran said, well, you're home, boy, and I'm glad you are. I like your woman. She's no whining ninny.
I married her, said Torin simply.
Well, that's another thing altogether, boy.
His eyes darkened. It's a foolish way to tie up the future. In my longer life and more experienced, I never did such a thing.
Randu interrupted from the corner where he stood quietly.
Now, Fransart, what comparisons are you making? To your crash landing 6 years ago, you were never in one spot long enough to establish residence requirements for marriage. And since then, who would have you?
The one-armed man jerked erect in his seat and replied hotly,
many, you snowy dotard.
Torin said with hasty tact, it's largely a legal formality, Dad. The situation has its conveniences.
Mostly for the woman, grumbled Fran.
And even if so, agreed Randu, it's up to the boy to decide. Marriage is an old custom among the Foundationers.
The Foundationers are not fit models for an honest trader, smoldered Fran.
Torin broke in again. My wife is a Foundationer.
He looked from one to the other and then said quietly, she's coming.
The conversation took a general turn after the evening meal, which Fran had spiced with three tales of reminiscence composed of equal parts of blood, women, prophets, and embroidery. The small televisor was on and some classic drama was playing itself out in an unregarded whisper. Randu had hitched himself into a more comfortable position on the low couch and gazed past the slow smoke of his long pipe to where Beta had knelt down upon the softness of the white fur mat, brought back once long ago from a trade mission, and now spread out only upon the most ceremonious occasions.
"You have studied history, my girl?" he asked pleasantly.
Beta nodded.
"I was the despair of my teachers, but I learned a bit eventually."
A citation for scholarship, put in Torin smugly, that's all.
And what did you learn? Proceeded Randu smoothly.
Everything?
Now? Laughed the girl.
The old man smiled gently.
Well then, what do you think of the galactic situation?
I think, said Beta concisely, that a Selden crisis is pending. And that if it isn't, then away with the Selden plan altogether. It is a failure.
Phew, muttered Fran from his corner. What a way to speak of Selden.
But he said nothing aloud. Randu sucked at his pipe speculatively.
Indeed. Why do you say that?
I was to the Foundation, you know, in my younger days, and I, too, once thought great dramatic thoughts.
But now, why do you say that?
Well, Beta's eyes misted with thought as she curled her bare toes into the white softness of the rug and nestled her little chin in one plump hand. It seems to me that the whole essence of Selden's plan was to create a world better than the ancient one of the Galactic Empire.
It was falling apart, that world, 3 centuries ago, when Selden first established the Foundation. And if history speaks truly, it was falling apart of the triple disease of inertia, despotism, and maldistribution of the goods of the universe.
Randu nodded slowly, while Torin gazed with proud, luminous eyes at his wife, and Fran in the corner clucked his tongue and carefully refilled his glass.
Beta said, if the story of Selden is true, He foresaw the complete collapse of the Empire through his laws of psychohistory, and was able to predict the necessary 30,000 years of barbarism before the establishment of a new Second Empire to restore civilization and culture to humanity. It was the whole aim of his life work to set up such conditions as would ensure a speedier rejuvenation. The deep voice of Fran burst out, "And that's why he established the two foundations, honor be to his name." "And that's why he established the two foundations," assented Beta. "Our foundation was a gathering of the scientists of the dying empire, intended to carry on the science and learning of man to new heights. And the foundation was so situated in space, and the historical environment was such that, through the careful calculations of his genius, Selden foresaw that in 1,000 years it would become a newer, greater empire." There was a reverent silence. The girl said softly, "It's an old story. You all know it. For almost 3 centuries, every human being of the Foundation has known it. But I thought it would be appropriate to go through it, just quickly. Today is Selden's birthday, you know, and even if I am of the Foundation and you are of Haven, we have that in common." She lit a cigarette slowly and watched the glowing tip absently. "The laws of history are as absolute as the laws of physics, and if the probabilities of error are greater, it is only because history does not deal with as many humans as physics does atoms, so that individual variations count for more. Selden predicted a series of crises through the 1,000 years of growth, each of which would force a new turning of our history into a pre-calculated path. It is those crises which direct us, and therefore a crisis must come now." "Now," she repeated forcefully. "It's almost a century since the last one, and in that century every vice of the Empire has been repeated in the Foundation. Inertia. Our ruling class knows one law, no change. Despotism. They know one rule, force. Maldistribution. They know one desire, to hold what is theirs." "While others starve," roared Fran suddenly with a mighty blow of his fist upon the arm of his chair. "Girl, your words are pearls. The fat guts on their money bags ruin the Foundation, while the brave traders hide their poverty on dregs of worlds like Haven. It's a disgrace to Selden, a casting of dirt in his face, a spewing in his beard." He raised his arm high, and then his face lengthened. "If I had my other arm, if once they had listened to me." "Dad," said Torrin, "take it easy." "Take it easy, take it easy," his father mimicked savagely. "We'll live here and die here forever, and you say take it easy." "That's our modern Lathe Endeavors," said Randu, gesturing with his pipe. "This Fran of ours. Devers died in the slave mines 80 years ago with your husband's great-grandfather because he lacked wisdom and didn't lack heart." "Yes, by the galaxy, I'd do the same if I were he," swore Fran. "Devers was the greatest traitor in history. Greater than the overblown windbag Mallow the Foundationers worship. If the cutthroats who lord the Foundation killed him because he loved justice, the greater the blood debt owed them." "Go on, girl," said Randu. "Go on, or surely he'll talk all the night and rave all the next day." "There's nothing to go on about," she said with a sudden gloom. "There must be a crisis, but I don't know how to make one. The progressive forces on the Foundation are oppressed fearfully. You traders may have the will, but you are hunted and disunited. If all the forces of goodwill in and out of the Foundation could combine...
Fran's laugh was a raucous jeer. Listen to her, Randu, listen to her. In and out of the Foundation, she says. Girl, girl, there's no hope in the flab sides of the Foundation. Among them, some hold the whip, and the rest are whipped. Dead whipped. Not enough spunk left in the whole rotten world to outface one good traitor.
Beta's attempted interruptions broke feebly against the overwhelming wind.
Torrin leaned over and put a hand over her mouth. Dad, he said coldly, you've never been on the Foundation. You know nothing about it. I tell you that the underground there is brave and daring enough. I could tell you that Beta was one of them.
All right, boy, no offense. Now where's the cause for anger?
He was genuinely perturbed.
Torrin drove on fervently. The trouble with you, Dad, is that you've got a provincial outlook. You think because some 100,000 traitors scurry into holes on an unwanted planet at the end of nowhere that they're a great people. Of course, any tax collector from the Foundation that gets here never leaves again, but that's cheap heroism. What would you do if the Foundation sent a fleet?
We'd blast them, said Fran sharply.
And get blasted, with the balance in their favor. You're outnumbered, outarmed, outorganized, and as soon as the Foundation thinks it worth its while, you'll realize that. So you had better seek your allies on the Foundation itself if you can.
Randu, said Fran, looking at his brother like a great, helpless bull.
Randu took his pipe away from his lips.
The boy's right, Fran. When you listen to the little thoughts deep inside you, you know he is. But they're uncomfortable thoughts, so you drown them out with that roar of yours. But they're still there.
Torrin, I'll tell you why I brought all this up.
He puffed thoughtfully a while, then dipped his pipe into the neck of the tray, waited for the silent flash, and withdrew it clean. Slowly he filled it again with precise taps of his little finger. He said, Your little suggestion of Foundation's interest in us, Torrin, is to the point. There have been two recent visits lately, for tax purposes. The disturbing point is that the second visitor was accompanied by a light patrol ship. They landed in Glayar City, giving us the miss for a change, and they never lifted off again, naturally. But now they'll surely be back. Your father is aware of all this, Torrin. He really is. Look at the stubborn rake, Hell. He knows Haven is in trouble, and he knows we're helpless, but he repeats his formulas. It warms and protects him. But once he's had his say and roared his defiance and feels he's discharged his duty as a man and a bull trader, why, he's as reasonable as any of us.
Any of who? Asked Beta.
He smiled at her.
We've formed a little group, Beta, just in our city. We haven't done anything yet. We haven't even managed to contact the other cities yet, but it's a start.
But towards what?
Randu shook his head.
We don't know.
Yet.
We hope for a miracle.
We have decided that, as you say, a Selden crisis must be at hand.
He gestured widely upwards.
The galaxy is full of the chips and splinters of the broken empire. The generals swarm. Do you suppose the time may come when one will grow bold?
Beta considered and shook her head decisively, so that the long straight hair with the single inward curl at the end swirled about her ears.
No, not a chance. There's not one of those generals who doesn't know that an attack on the Foundation is suicide. Bel Rios of the old Empire was a better man than any of them,
and he attacked with the resources of a galaxy and couldn't win against the Selden plan. Is there one general that doesn't know that?
But what if we spur them on?
Into where? Into an atomic furnace? With what could you possibly spur them?
Well, there is one. A new one. In this past year or two, there has come word of a strange man whom they call the Mule.
The Mule? She considered. Ever hear of him, Torrey?
Torrin shook his head.
She said, what about him?
I don't know. But he wins victories at, they say, impossible odds. The rumors may be exaggerated, but it would be interesting in any case to become acquainted with him. Not every man with sufficient ability and sufficient ambition would believe in Harry Selden and his laws of psychohistory. We could encourage that disbelief. He might attack. And the Foundation would win.
Yes, but not necessarily easily. It might be a crisis, and we could take advantage of such a crisis to force a compromise with the despots of the Foundation. At the worst, they would forget us long enough to enable us to plan farther.
What do you think, Torrey? Torrin smiled feebly and pulled at a loose brown curl that fell over one eye.
The way he describes it, it can't hurt.
But who is the Mule? What do you know of him, Randu?
Nothing yet.
For that, we could use you, Torrin. And your wife, if she's willing.
We've talked of this, your father and I. We've talked of this thoroughly.
In what way, Randu? What do you want of us?
The young man cast a quick, inquisitive look at his wife.
Have you had a honeymoon?
Well, yes, if you can call the trip from the Foundation a honeymoon.
How about a better one on Calgan?
It's semi-tropical. Beaches, water sports, bird hunting, quite the vacation spot.
It's about 7,000 parsecs in, not too far.
What's on Calgan?
The Mule. His men, at least. He took it last month, and without a battle, though Calgan's warlord broadcast a threat to blow the planet to ionic dust before giving it up.
Where's the warlord now?
He isn't, said Randu, with a shrug.
What do you say?
But what are we to do?
I don't know.
Fran and I are old. We're provincial. The traders of Haven are all essentially provincial. Even you say so. Our trading is of a very restricted sort, and we're not the galaxy roamers our ancestors were.
Shut up, Fran. But you too know the galaxy. Beta especially speaks with a nice Foundation accent. We merely wish whatever you can find out. If you can make contact. But we wouldn't expect that.
Suppose you two think it over. You can meet our entire group if you wish.
Oh, not before next week. You ought to have some time to catch your breath.
There was a pause, and then Fran roared, "Who wants another drink? I mean, besides me." Chapter 12. Captain and Mayor. Captain Han Pritchard was unused to the luxury of his surroundings and by no means impressed. As a general thing, he discouraged self-analysis and all forms of philosophy and metaphysics not directly connected with his work. It helped. His work consisted largely of what the War Department called intelligence, the sophisticates, espionage, and the romanticists, spy stuff. And unfortunately, despite the frothy shrillness of the televisors,
Intelligence, espionage, and spy stuff are at best a sordid business of routine betrayal and bad faith. It is excused by society since it is in the interest of the state, but since philosophy seemed always to lead Captain Pritchard to the conclusion that even in that holy interest, society is much more easily soothed than one's own conscience, he discouraged philosophy. And now, in the luxury of the mayor's anteroom, his thoughts turned inward despite himself. Men had been promoted over his head continuously, though of lesser ability. That much was admitted. He had withstood an eternal rain of black marks and official reprimands and survived it. And stubbornly he had held to his own way and the firm belief that insubordination in that same holy interest of the state would yet be recognized for the service it was. So here he was in the anteroom of the mayor, with five soldiers as a respectful guard and probably a court-martial awaiting him. The heavy marble doors rolled apart smoothly, silently, revealing satiny walls, a red plastic carpeting, and two more marble doors, metal inlaid within. Two officials in the straight-lined costume of three centuries back stepped out and called, "An audience to Captain Han Pritchard of Information." They stepped back with a ceremonious bow as the captain started forward. His escort stopped at the outer door and he entered the inner alone. On the other side of the doors, in a large room strangely simple, behind a large desk, strangely angular, sat a small man, almost lost in the immensity. Mayor Indber, successively the third of that name, was the grandson of the first Indber, who had been brutal and capable, and who had exhibited the first quality in spectacular fashion by his manner of seizing power, and the latter by the skill with which he put an end to the last farcical remnants of free election, and the even greater skill with which he maintained a relatively peaceful rule. Mayor Indber was also the son of the second Indber, who was the first mayor of the Foundation to succeed to his post by right of birth, and who was only half his father, for he was merely brutal. So Mayor Indber was the third of the name and the second to succeed by right of birth, and he was the least of the three, for he was neither brutal nor capable, but merely an excellent bookkeeper born wrong. Indber the third was a peculiar combination of ersatz characteristics to all but himself. To him, a stilted geometric love of arrangement was system, an indefatigable and feverish interest in the pettiest facets of day-to-day bureaucracy was industry, indecision when right was caution, and blind stubbornness when wrong, determination. And withal, he wasted no money, killed no man needlessly, and meant extremely well. If Captain Pritchard's gloomy thoughts ran along these lines as he remained respectfully in place before the large desk, the wooden arrangement of his features yielded no insight into the fact. He neither coughed, shifted weight, nor shuffled his feet until the thin face of the mayor lifted slowly as the busy stylus ceased in its task of marginal notations, and a sheet of close-printed paper was lifted from one neat stack and placed upon another neat stack. Mayor Indber clasped his hands carefully before him, deliberately refraining from disturbing the careful arrangement of desk accessories. He said in acknowledgment, "Captain Han Pritchard of Information." And Captain Pritchard, in strict obedience to protocol, bent one knee nearly to the ground and bowed his head until he heard the words of release. "Arise, Captain Pritchard." The mayor said with an air of warm sympathy, "You are here, Captain Pritchard, because of certain disciplinary action taken against yourself by your superior officer. The papers concerning such action have come, in the ordinary course of events, to my notice, and since no event in the Foundation is of disinterest to me, I took the trouble to ask for further information on your case. You are not, I hope, surprised?" Captain Pritchard said unemotionally, "Excellence, no. Your justice is proverbial, Is it? Is it? His tone was pleased, and the tinted contact lenses he wore caught the light in a manner that imparted a hard, dry gleam to his eyes. Meticulously, he fanned out a series of metal-bound folders before him. The parchment sheets within crackled sharply as he turned them, his long finger following down the line as he spoke.
"I have your record here, Captain. Complete. You are 43 and have been an officer of the armed forces for 17 years. You were born in Loris, of Anacreonian parents. No serious childhood diseases. An attack of myo... well, that's of no importance. Education, pre-military at the Academy of Sciences. Major, hyper-engines. Academic standing... very good. You are to be congratulated. Enter the army as under-officer on the 102nd day of the 293rd year of the Foundation era."
He lifted his eyes momentarily as he shifted the first folder and opened the second.
"You see," he said, "in my administration, nothing is left to chance. Order. System."
He lifted a pink, scented jelly globule to his lips. It was his one vice, and but dolingly indulged in. Witness the fact that the mayor's desk lacked that almost inevitable atom flash for the disposal of dead tobacco. For the mayor did not smoke. Nor, as a matter of course, did his visitors. The mayor's voice droned on methodically, slurringly, mumblingly, now and then interspersed with whispered comments of equally mild and equally ineffectual commendation or reproof. Slowly, he replaced the folders as originally, in a single, neat pile.
"Well, Captain," he said briskly, "your record is unusual. Your ability is outstanding, it would seem, and your services valuable beyond question. I note that you have been wounded in the line of duty twice, and that you have been awarded the Order of Merit for bravery beyond the call of duty. Those are facts not lightly to be minimized."
Captain Pritchard's expressionless face did not soften. He remained stiffly erect. Protocol required that a subject honored by an audience with the mayor may not sit down. A point perhaps needlessly reinforced by the fact that only one chair existed in the room, the one underneath the mayor. Protocol further required no statements other than those needed to answer a direct question. The mayor's eyes bore down hard upon the soldier, and his voice grew pointed and heavy.
"However, you have not been promoted in 10 years. And your superiors report over and over again of the unbending stubbornness of your character. You are reported to be chronically insubordinate, incapable of maintaining a correct attitude towards superior officers, apparently uninterested in maintaining frictionless relationships with your colleagues, and an incurable troublemaker besides. How do you explain that, Captain?"
"Excellence, I do what seems right to me. My deeds on behalf of the state, and my wounds in that cause bear witness that what seems right to me is also in the interest of the state."
"A soldierly statement, Captain, but a dangerous doctrine. More of that later. Specifically, you are charged with refusing an assignment 3 times in the face of orders signed by my legal delegates. What have you to say to that?"
"Excellence, the assignment lacks significance in a critical time, where matters of first importance are being ignored."
"Ah, and who tells you these matters you speak of are of the first importance at all? And if they are, who tells you further that they are ignored?"
"Excellence, these things are quite evident to me. My experience and my knowledge of events, the value of neither of which my superiors deny, make it plain.
But, my good Captain, are you blind that you do not see that by arrogating to yourself the right to determine intelligence policy, you usurp the duties of your superior?"
Excellence, my duty is primarily to the state and not to my superior. Fallacious, for your superior has his superior, and that superior is myself, and I am the state.